I'm someone who loves trying out different makeup looks, but doesn't really wear much on a daily basis, so I like to focus on making sure I have high quality staples. And whether you like a fresh face, full glam, or somewhere in between, you've probably seen Thrive Cosmetics Viral Tubing Mascara. I've certainly seen it everywhere. You know, the one in the turquoise tube? So that mascara, along with all of Thrive Cosmetics' beauty products, are certified 100% vegan and cruelty-free, which I look for in makeup, and they've got excellent quality to match. And something I didn't know from all the mascara videos I've seen is that for every product sold, Thrive Cosmetics donates either that same product, another product that is needed more, or a monetary donation. They've worked with over 500 nonprofits to help with a wide range of causes like supporting cancer survivors, people experiencing homelessness, education access, and so much more. Knowing that makes me feel even better about using their products. And I do enjoy using them. Like I said, I like having high quality staples, and so my favorites are products that are multi-purpose, like the Brilliant Eye Brightener. It comes in a bunch of colors, and I like using them as eyeliner, eyeshadow, and even highlighter. Thrive Cosmetics is luxury beauty that gives back. Right now, you can get an exclusive 20% off your first order at thrivecosmetics.com/thrive. That's Thrive Cosmetics, CAUSEMETICS, .com/thrive for 20% off your first order.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hey, so before we get into today's episode, I wanted to let you know about a podcast that I'm pretty sure you're going to like that is called Bad Women, hosted by historian Hallie Rubenhold. And if you're like, I recognize that name, that's because I recommended her book a few episodes ago. She wrote a book called The Five that was about five of the women who were killed by Jack the Ripper. And her podcast, Bad Women, expands on the same stuff that she talks about in her book. So on Bad Women, historian Hallie Rubenhold uncovers the real lives of Jack the Ripper's victims, revealing the discrimination that put them in his path, the same sort of misogyny women still face today. This show challenges established theories about the murders, causing many supposed Ripper experts to see red. Find Bad Women wherever you get your podcasts. Like where you're listening to this, you can find Bad Women that same place. Hello, and welcome to Vulgar History, a feminist women's history comedy podcast. My name is Anne Foster, and today I have a super special treat for you and for me. It is an interview that I did over Zoom with the author Lucy Jago, who is the author of the historical fiction book A Net for Small Fishes, which just came out. You should be able to buy it right away. That's why I waited until this week to air this episode, to make sure the book was there. You know, pending supply issues, paper shortages and things. Anyway, the book has come out. Don't worry about it. It was printed. Everything's fine. So it just came out in North America, and it's been out in the UK for a bit longer. And that is why I was able to read it several months ago, because I couldn't wait for the North American release of this book. I had to read it right away. And why is that? Because it's a historical fiction book about the one and only Tits Out Frances Howard. Yes, it is a Frances Howard-based historical fiction book. But as you will learn in this interview, and then subsequently when you read the book, you'll also notice that it's a book about, the main character isn't Frances herself, it's Anne Turner, who is one of the people who was also arrested eventually for the whole murder of Thomas Overbury scenario. But the book is very much about them, these two women, they're how they came from two different worlds, how they became friends, and what it was like for them as women living in this pretty intense time period with some pretty awful men all around them. Anyway, I don't want to give too much preamble. The interview, I think, super interesting. The audio quality is like if you were having a Zoom call yourself, because it's got the trademark lo-fi sound quality that you all love about this podcast. So anyway, I really hope you enjoy this interview, and I'll pop back afterwards to say a bit more stuff.
Okay, so I'm here with Lucy Jago, who's just come back from, what was it? It was a book event.
Durham Literary Festival.
Yeah, and how did that go?
It's so lovely to be in front of real human beings again.
Mm-hmm. It was a real actual, well, because your book came out in the UK, what was it?
In February, and of course that was lockdown, so all the bookshops were shut. But now festivals, literary festivals are happening. So I've been traveling around quite a bit, going to different festivals and meeting people who've read the book, and it's just wonderful. Because up to now, you know, all the bookshops were shut when it came out.
Oh my goodness, yeah, because in the UK it was like a serious shutdown, like everything was closed, right? Yeah.
Total shutdown.
Mm-hmm. And then the reason why we're talking especially is because your book is just, well, this is going to air, I think, just the day after it comes out in North America. So
very exciting.
So Annette for Small Fishes is going to be coming across the pond. It'll be available all over the place. So my first question, like, I'm so excited to talk to you. As you know, myself and the listeners of this podcast are fans of Frances Howard. That's where we're coming at it from. But first, could you tell me how you found out about the story of the murder of Thomas Overbury? How did it get your attention?
Well, I was in the London Library, which is, I used to live in London, now I live in the countryside, but I used to work in there. And I'd just finished my previous novel, and I was literally browsing. It's an open shelf, amazing old library. I was browsing through the shelves, came across this book about, I can't remember if it was called Wicked Women or some dreadful title like that. And I was sort of leafing through it, and there was a two-line mention of these women who had poisoned and murdered and were witches and all this sort of thing. And I thought, gosh, that really doesn't sound very likely. So I started getting books out on the Overbury Affair. And honestly, during that week, I got crosser and crosser that all these historical accounts, whether they were 400 years old or 40 years old, just took the male point of view in this affair, even though it was the women who were absolutely at the center of it. They were, in all these accounts, they were largely peripheral and their motivations were not examined at all. And I got so cross about this that I just thought, right, I'm going to find out about these women and I'm going to understand them better than these historical accounts have so far.
Well, and that's definitely something, like, just this podcast, Vulgar History, it's very much every single woman that I've profiled, I think, has been, the main account of their life has been through some man who hated them. And so it's, for my work, it's been a lot of just sort of dissecting, okay, well, what actually happened, and trying to get past these biases. So you talked about women. So the listeners of this podcast know very well about Frances Howard, but who is the other woman you're talking about?
Mistress Anne Turner. So she is often dismissed as Frances's sidekick. And that's about all you ever hear, that she's the widow of a doctor and thus she must have had access to poisons and so on. And that's it. You don't really hear anymore. Oh, and actually that she, some accounts do mention that she was designing costumes for Inigo Jones, for the masks, for Queen Anna. And I think maybe one person mentioned about the ruffs, but in the main historical account, she is just dismissed as a sort of sidekick. But very interested in her.
Okay, you mentioned the ruffs, and we really need to get into the ruffs. Can you just describe for everybody? Because I found, just in looking up about Anne Turner, like, she was a trailblazer in fashion.
She really was. I mean, I don't know if in Canada this had much impact on you, but in England we had a designer called Catherine Hamnett. She went to meet Margaret Thatcher wearing a t-shirt emblazoned 58% of the population say no to Pershing missiles. You know, very, very dramatic, political, bold statements.
Yeah.
And this yellow ruff was not dissimilar to that. Mm-hmm. So when I started doing all this research, I wanted to avoid talking about fashion because I thought it was such a cliche to have two women as my main characters and then to go on and on about fashion. But as I did more and more research, so about year four of the research, it began really clear to me that fashion was absolutely a real focal point of the book, and it was a place where people made points, and they made political points, they made statements about fashion and nationality and about sexuality and about power. And so these yellow ruffs were considered very, very dangerous when Anne Turner introduced them into the court, because yellow was associated with Catholicism, because saffron the colour comes from saffron largely, or urine. I can talk about that later, but saffron mainly came from Catholic countries, so Spain and Italy, and it was imported into England via Ireland, also a Catholic country at that point, almost entirely at that point, and a sort of site of rebellion. So yellow was associated also with this, a thing called the Irish mantle, which was like a shaggy coat that was very practical. And people leading the English army wanted to have this coat for the soldiers, but the king refused. And finally, he totally banned it, because yellow, and this particularly this coat, was associated with everybody wore this coat, so men and women. So it was defying gender boundaries. Every class wore it, from the most aristocratic to the poorest. So that was subverting these very strict hierarchies of class. Mm-hmm. And so King James banned these Irish mantles, yet they snuck into the court. And so fashionable English aristocrats were wearing these, a sort of upmarket silk version of these mantles. And Anne Turner introduces this yellow patent starch recipe, that's her own patent starch recipe, yellow. And it's making a statement. It's making a statement about gender and about power and about rebellion.
So can you explain where the ruffs would be on somebody's ensemble? Is it a collar ruff or a cuff?
Well, it could be cuffs and, so the ruff went around the neck, and they could be various sizes, but the ones in the portrait of Francis, which your listeners probably know, is a normal a ruff that sort of sticks out. You also had these what are called falling bands, which is a more a less starch version of a ruff, so it sort of falls down around you, more like we would think of as a collar. And also the ruffs around the wrists, so cuffs.
And so the alternate to the yellow would be just white. So basically the ruffs were white, and then suddenly she brought in yellow. Was that the point?
Well, before yellow, apparently what was fashionable was goose turd green, which was sort of sludgy green, I can imagine it as. And before that, blue. Okay. But in a lot of the paintings you see white, and I wonder, some of that might be because of colour having faded, or white was a more Puritan colour. So if your religious leanings were more Protestant, you were more likely to wear white, is my thinking. And of course, yellow was associated, as I've said, with Catholicism, and Frances Howard was a Catholic from a Catholic family, as was Mistress Turner, so that the whole Overbury scandal, there's an awful lot of religious tension in there, as well as political and sexual stuff going on.
And so the book opens, like, where you have the two of them meeting, Frances and Anne, for the first time, is because Anne has been brought in to make over Frances, basically.
Exactly. It's perfectly put,
So was that, from your research, is that part of what the relationship was? Like, Anne helped Frances with her clothing supplies? Or is that an invention of your book?
It's part invention, not entirely. So it is, there were documents at the time, letters written at the time, accusing, rather than applauding, but accusing Anne Turner of having introduced this seditious, vain fashion thing, this yellow cuffs and ruffs, into the court. And that was at the time. So it's pretty likely she did do this. And then I went to the National Portrait Gallery, and there is a picture of Frankie, as I know her, because that's how her family addressed her. And I feel I know her so well now. I can't help but call her Frankie. There she is wearing a yellow ruff. In this portrait. So it made sense to me that perhaps that is how they met. So no one knows for sure how they met, but it would make sense that Frankie was known later on as being highly fashionable. Anne is known as having introduced these cuffs and ruffs, this yellow starch, into the court. So it made sense to me that that is how they met. But yes, that is largely my putting two and two together.
Yeah, absolutely, makes sense.
But it's not fanciful. I mean, it's just based on different bits of research that seems the most likely. And of course, their families would have known each other. They both came from the sort of east part of this country, and then in those days, society was pretty small. So they almost certainly knew each other from quite young.
Well, that's what my next question is going to be. So, Frances Howard, she's from the Howard family, you know, which Catherine Howard, like, related to the Boleyns, like the Howard family is well known quantity. So Anne Turner, what was her sort of class? What was her family's background?
Well, now we might call her middle class. I mean, they didn't really have a middle class at the time, but they had this thing they called the middling sort. So you were of the gentlemanly class or the gentle class. So it meant you weren't, in theory, working for a living. So you weren't tilling the fields and you weren't emptying sewers and things like that. They worked in a way because her husband was a doctor, but he was a court doctor, and Queen Elizabeth herself rated him highly and wrote letters to the College of Physicians. At one point, it looked like his Catholicism would stop him being elected to a high position in the College of Physicians. And Elizabeth wrote a letter commending him and basically saying, don't let his Catholicism stop his election. Mm-hmm. So she really rated him. So he was definitely moving in the court and probably was more on the peripheries of the court, wanting to get into the court, because that's where she would have a good market for her fashionable ideas. So they were sort of lower gentlemanly class. They were not wealthy, and he died in debt, very indebted. So as becomes clear in the book, a lot of what goes on at the court is a facade. People are living in huge amounts of debt, looking utterly glamorous, dripping in jewels, but deeply indebted either to the bankers of the city or to the king himself. It's part of the way he controls his court, is to keep his courtiers indebted to him. Mm-hmm. So they are on the edges of that sort of aristocratic life, but they themselves are not by any means aristocrats. So her grandfather, so her mother's father was a sir. So he had been knighted, but her mother had lost that title by marrying out of that class, and she married a yeoman class. So upper middle class, we might call it today. So quite a well-off farmer with land, probably not farming himself, but having tenants that did it for him, but not really the gentleman class. Mm-hmm.
And so I was looking at your website, and there's, you know, highlights from various reviews from various people. Somebody referred to Frankie and Anne as the Thelma and Louise of their time.
Exactly.
So was that part of, you said you were researching and you saw the references to the two of them. So were you always thinking in terms of the book, you wanted to be like about the two women and their friendship and this murder that they were both involved in?
Yeah, to be honest, I was not very interested in the murder. I really wasn't. I wasn't that interested in who sent poison jellies and tarts in at what, you know, I'm not a crime writer. The trial itself is such an art of, you know, a work of fiction that you would never really be able to get to the bottom of it. Nowadays, we consider it a gross miscarriage of justice. I was much more interested in their friendship. It's so rare to find well-documented women in the historical record and to find a friendship between them even rarer. And that, I thought, was such an opportunity to look at something that is so little looked at in history or even in historical fiction, friendships between women, how that worked. And I've always been quite interested in domesticity. I mean, how was life? I'm more interested in the history of experience than the history of power. So I wanted to know what it was like to be them. And these historical accounts of the actual Overbury affair annoyed me so much by how they dismissed these women as just vain and lustful. And that was considered sufficient motivation for them to risk everything. Anne is the mother of six children. She's not going to go and poison someone willy-nilly out of vanity and lust when she's got six little ones at home that she's looking after. And it's not even for her benefit, but for this other woman's benefit. So the complexity of their friendship and why Anne got so involved in this affair. I'm not saying they didn't try and poison him. I'm not trying to whitewash them. What I'm trying to do is give them much greater complexity. And to do that, you have to understand their lives, what was stopping them doing what they wanted to do, what were all the sort of nets and sort of ties on them and the things that stopped them doing what they wanted to do. What were those? What was going on for them? And why did they break out in such a dramatic way? How did that happen? So I'm much more interested in the how than in the actual Overbury poisoning, because I also find the accounts focus on that so much. And it's to me, it's not nearly as interesting as the backstory.
Well, and I found that interesting too, just going through reading your book. I was like, oh, okay, like you're going very, I was like, well, it became very clear this is not a book about the murder itself. Mm. Like there is, there's another novel, The Poison Bed by E.C. Freemantle, which is very much like sort of a whodunit about the murder itself. And yours, like the murder, I don't know, I'm going to say like, it happens two thirds of the way through. Like it's not like a book is building up to a murder and then the murder happens. It's like that's just a thing that sort of naturally evolves out of the friendship and everything you're saying about the exploration mm-hmm. of their domestic life. And well, so, I mean, we can't not talk about the murder, but it was, Frances was in this terrible marriage.
Yeah. I mean, she had got divorced before this murder happened. And at the time, the divorce was as scandalous as a murder, pretty much. I mean, it caused absolute uproar in Jacobean society because King Henry VIII had managed to do it, but almost no one else got divorced. It was harder to get divorced in England than it was in Italy. So for a woman to want to divorce a man was seen as absolutely heinous. And her reputation suffered enormously by that because she was considered to be oversexed because she wanted to get out of this marriage. She was considered to be disobedient, unchaste. She was speaking about, you know, she was considered to, basically she broke all rules of what women were meant to do. Mm-hmm. And so that, so already there was massive scandal around her, even though she was married to a man who was impotent with her. He had been unable to consummate the marriage. So the marriage had not been consummated. He hated women. And yet to want to get out of that marriage was seen as really going against all decency.
That's so, wild when you're saying like unchaste or that she's oversexed, where it's like she's literally chaste. And like she was part of the trial was like proving her virginity. Like that was,
I know. Yeah. But how outrageous is that? Because the reason the marriage wasn't working, or one of them, is that he admitted to being impotent with her. So he slept with prostitutes, it is said, and he certainly said he was able to do it with other women, just not with her. So his lack of chastity, his sleeping with whoever was all right. Mm-hmm. But for her to have done that would have been considered absolutely terrible. So that the hypocrisy in it is mind-blowing. Mm-hmm. And it seemed to me this was so interesting. Why would you skim over all that just to focus on a murder? And to understand the potential, whether they had or had not murdered this man, to understand the complexity of their motive, you have to understand this whole thing around the divorce. You have to understand how unhappy and miserable her marriage was, and how imprisoned she was in what her family needed her to do. So she was married to Essex because her family had his father beheaded. So his father being beheaded, he'd lost his title and his lands because of his father being committed treason or accused of treason. Sorry, I've been on this train for so long. I'm not feeling very articulate. So because he was executed for treason, the Essex that Frankie marries lost everything. And he was a very bitter, very angry man. And so the family get her to marry him in order to try and contain him, to stop him being their enemy, to try and control him, basically, by marrying him into their clan. So imagine being forced to marry a man whose father was beheaded at your family's, basically, at their, due to their influence. So it's not a good way to start a marriage. Mm-hmm.
And then, I love like the angle you took with the book and just everything you're saying about the research, because when I was reading up on it, so much of it was just like Frances and this, it's not even a love triangle. I'm trying to think of how many sides there are. It's like a love, like pentagon of like her, Carr, the king, Overbury, George Villiers is involved. So it's just kind of like, it's this love amorphous shape and she's the only woman in it. And so I think a lot of things are focusing on what the men were up to.
Yeah.
But so she was in this horrible marriage. She met Robert Carr. Can you explain about Robert Carr's involvement with the king, mm-hmm. and how that whole angle of it?
Yes. So Robert Carr was the king's favorite and probably lover. I mean, there is a letter saying, well, the letter that's in the book shows how much the king loved him. And the king had favorites throughout his life, male favourites. And so there's a lot of historical research into this. So of course, there's nowhere where he's actually written, "I am a gay man." Of course, people don't write about their sexuality like that then. But most historians agree he was bisexual. And by this point, his wife had moved out. They were living in separate palaces, and Carr had no bed of his own. He slept in the king's bed. So that was the situation. And Carr had known him since he was very young. And when Frankie meets Carr, she falls in love. I mean, she was of the age when she can choose for herself who she wants to fall in love with. You know, instead of being pushed into an arranged marriage by her family with someone she barely knows, she meets Carr. And in my view of it is that that's when they fall in love. And that's, and she wants him, and he clearly wanted her. So, you know, the sexuality of Carr, he was said to be very effeminate, and how, so people did write about him, people were very angry that he had this political power, because he came from fairly lowly background. He wasn't very educated. He spoke with such a strong Scottish accent that the English nobles couldn't understand him. And this is part of what we have to understand about the English court at this point. The English nobles were very angry that here is Queen Elizabeth died, here's come the Scottish king, and he comes down with a large number of his circle who he then gives power and influence to, and they all speak with this very broad accent that the English nobles can't understand, and they complain about this a great deal. And the king is also giving vast amounts of money and land to his favorite. So Robert Carr shoots up in wealth and in titles. He's given very senior titles. He's the first Scot to sit in the House of Lords, so he's given an English peerage. And of course, this creates vast amounts of jealousy. And so Frankie, of course, is a nice, easy victim, someone on whom the English court can focus their ire, their jealousy, their fury. She can become the scapegoat. So she is used in that way to get back at Carr at the time. But what shocked me so much is that accounts since still see her as the epitome of female villainy, that dreadful stereotype of malicious, irrational, vain, a sort of evil. Mm-hmm. And even modern accounts haven't really bothered to challenge that, to really look into what happened and see whether really were Frankie and Anne just these sort of evil, vacuous idiots who sort of wanted something and didn't look at the consequences and sent in all these poison jellies. Really, I felt that was unlikely.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you touched on this a bit, so like that he was an effeminate man, like the gender roles at the time. Mm. Can you talk about that? Because you get into that in the book, and it's very interesting how the men were very, that was, we'll just talk about it. So how the men were very fancy, the wigs, the everything, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So, well, there were different factions of court, of course. So it's interesting when you look at Frankie. So she has two husbands. So the first one is the Earl of Essex. So he is a Puritan. Well, he is a Protestant, a very strict Protestant, hates the Catholics. When he did his tour of Europe, he wouldn't even go to Italy and Spain because they were Catholic countries. So he wouldn't even set foot in them. Mm-hmm. He will only wear English clothes. So English cloth, English wool, mainly brown, black and white, well, because of this creamy color, very dour, against luxury and so on. So that's him. But she falls in love with Robert Carr, who is the opposite. So he's very feminine. So Essex is all into martial arts. Well, so sort of that doesn't mean kung fu. It means practicing swordsmanship and being ready for war at any point. And he hangs out mainly with his men and with his horses and dogs. So that's him. So Robert Carr, very interested in fashion. So to get the king's eye at this point, the king was not a very attractive man, but he loved to surround himself by beautiful men. And his view of beautiful men was very effeminate. So there are all these descriptions of them being smooth-faced. So men who shaved, who tried to have no stubble on their face, that was seen as much very effeminate. Whereas if you wanted to be masculine, you had a big beard. So, but the king's favourites had smooth faces, they curled, or frizzed as they called it, they frizzed their hair, so they had lovely long curly locks around their faces, they wore a lot of jewellery, they wore silks, they wore soft outlines, they often would have their doublet just slightly open and so on. So it was said at the time they were trying to look like women. They were trying to like women, and that's what attracted the king. And it does seem to have been that way, that the king was very attracted to very beautiful, effeminate looking men. And so that's how Robert Carr got power, because he was beautiful and the king loved him and gave him a great deal of power. And then because he was beautiful.
So he was, well, as you said, like he and the king shared a bed, etc.
Yeah.
And then Robert Carr and Thomas Overbury, what was that relationship?
Right. So Thomas Overbury was Carr's secretary. I mean, initially they were just friends. They were mates. So Thomas is an English, he was knighted quite soon after he came to the court. So he was knighted because of his friendship with Carr. So he wasn't knighted before that, but he was the same sort of class, I suppose you might say, as Anne. So gentlemanly enough to be allowed into court. And he was older than Carr, and they had traveled together, and they were clearly very good friends initially, probably lovers, probably. Sir Thomas Overbury was never married. He didn't like women. He writes a lot of poetry, well, poetry in inverted commas, about women. And he was very jealous of any friendships that Carr had with other people, partly, I think, because of his love of Carr, but partly also because Carr was his ticket to power. So that was a very close relationship. Overbury claimed that he was the intelligence behind Carr, and Carr was behind the king. So basically, Overbury was very arrogant. Nobody liked him. There isn't a single account of anybody liking him. A lot of people absolutely loathed him. He was very, very, very arrogant. Everybody says, immensely arrogant man who basically claimed that he was running the country because he was the intelligence behind Carr, and the king did what Carr said. So he was not a popular man. When he was put in prison, nobody objected to it, even though it wasn't actually legal what happened. No one objected because everybody loathed him and was glad to see the back of him.
That reminds me of, sorry, if you, I've just been watching a lot of British procedural crime dramas. And it always, there's always, it's like a small village and there's one person and you're like, well, that's going to be the murder victim because like that person is mean and everyone hates them. And then sure enough, that's, so the fact that Thomas Overbury ends up being murdered, it's like, of course he was, like, who killed him? Like, who wouldn't? Yeah.
In terms of novelistic sort of process, in a way, it would have been nicer if I could have created a more complex picture of him, really. I wanted us to feel some sense of conflict at the fact that, you know, they were going to plot to kill this man. I wanted us to feel, oh, that's not great. But actually, I couldn't find a single redeeming feature for him. Literally, nobody says it like that. He's literally called arrogant and rude. And I mean, it's quite rare to find so much documented evidence of how unpleasant someone is.
Yeah, just from all directions. Yeah.
All directions. So I'm afraid Thomas Overbury gets, he's not a very nice man. And I don't try and make him so in the book.
Well, you have to be faithful to the research you're finding.
Yeah.
Everybody hated him. That. So we've got this sort of, so this Francis is in love with Carr. Carr is the favorite of the king, but then he's also, so Overbury. So you mentioned his like, quote unquote, poems he wrote. So he wrote about Francis, didn't he? Like saying she was terrible and stuff.
Well, it was thinly veiled, and it was about, it was called The Wife. And what you should seek in a wife. Honestly, if you, I mean, for any of us reading it today, it's so immensely anti-feminist. It sort of makes, it can barely read it, it sticks in your throat. But basically, wives should be pure, chaste, only ever married to one person, and so on. And there's a line, something like, even if you have a high title, that doesn't mean you shouldn't have good morals. So he's basically, it's aimed at Francis, saying that he shouldn't marry Frances because she's immoral, because she divorced Essex. And he just hated her, and he hated the Howards, So he was basically warning Carr off Frankie in a and big way, so, and in a public way, and dishonoring her by calling her, what was the word he called her? I'm trying to think. No, it wasn't a whore. Because whore had a different meaning then to what it has now. But he basically implied that she was dishonorable. And at the time, that was about the worst insult you could offer a woman. And there was no coming back from it unless he made a public apology. So he hugely damaged her, and she had no way, she had no redress. You know, women that were meant to just keep silent.
Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, what I found. Just, you've obviously done years of research on this, and I've done less. But just the fact that Frances was in this position, she was so powerless in so many directions. But then through the murder plot, or actually through the divorce first, like she just like struck out on her own, which was so rare. And so, and that's what I found so interesting about her. Like she didn't have power, but she found ways to still do things.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what I found so interesting about them both. That here were women who really did what they could to change their lives in a way that was appears to have been quite rare, or certainly isn't much documented. So it was absolutely fascinating, because so often we look back at history and the women are portrayed as victims or totally without agency, and you know, and of course legally that is often the case. They have no legal status, mm-hmm. at this period and so on, so they do appear to be very powerless. But when you look into the research, actually a lot of women were, I mean, it's common sense that all women were not silent, chaste and obedient. I mean, that might be the rule, but a bit like driving at 70 is the rule, doesn't mean we all stick to it. And at the time, there was so much mortality, a lot of men were dying, women would take over their businesses and so on. So women were actually far more active than is generally considered the case by the public. But the historians are getting in there now and really trying to work out how active women were. And they're coming up with lots of evidence of women running businesses and so on. So it's just that very few people have written about them, and they often don't get into the record. But of course they're out there doing things. And so the joy of finding Anne and Frankie's story is here were women who were doing things that have been documented, and we can actually see them manipulating their situation as best they can to get the outcomes they actually want. And yes, so the divorce is very much a case in point, that she managed to align what she wanted, which was to marry Carl, with what would be good for the family. So once she had made it absolutely clear there was no going back to Essex, they thought, okay, what do we, you know, how do we make the best of a bad job here? And Carl was the most powerful person at court after the king, and so a marriage with him would be advantageous to the Howard family. So I'm sure she played on that in order to get them to sue for divorce, because she herself wasn't allowed to, because she was a woman. So she had to get her father and her great uncle to do all the legal stuff for her. And you can see what arguments she could have put to them to get them finally to agree to do this.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that just speaks to, because in the book, like you're taking the historical things that happened and imagining, you know, conversations and things. But the fact that she was able to do this really speaks to a force of character, how charismatic she must have been, how intelligent mm-hmm. she must have been. When you see the outcomes of the things that she set about to accomplish.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And I just think it's great to have some women in the historical record that set out to do things for themselves.
So speaking of that, getting back to Anne Turner. So through her relationship with Frances Howard, the yellow ruffs and everything. Like she was able to get in with more and more the wealthier classes, to sort of step herself up through her entrepreneurship.
Mm-hmm.
Really. Can you speak about sort of how she was able to manipulate her circumstances?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, obviously all of this is my interpretation of historical facts. So a lot of this is for the research, when you're looking at women who are not aristocratic, even most aristocratic women, there's so little actual documented fact. You have to go out sideways and look and create the world in which they were able to move around. So, but Anne, I think, is a truly extraordinary character, more so really for me than Frankie. I love the fact she's not of the aristocratic class. So she can move between worlds. So she can move in the court, but she also moves in the back streets amongst the apothecaries and so on. And I feel this introduction of the yellow ruff was really quite revolutionary and very political. I think of her a bit like Vivian Westwood, you know, this idea of being political, very different, quite daring. She had a lover, the lovers mentioned in her husband's will. This was fairly well known, hence it comes out in the trial records. But I went to see the will itself in the archive. And there it is written, you know, there's £10 put aside in the will for Arthur, who was the lover, to have a golden ring inscribed, "May fate unite the lovers." I mean, that is actually in the will. Mm-hmm. That isn't something I've made up. So she was a woman who was living, clearly living according to what she wanted to do as much as she possibly could. And again, this is fascinating to me that this was going on. I mean, a lot of what I say in terms of her moving around the court is my assumption. But I, for example, whether she was a dresser to the Queen or not, that people have suggested that. There were comments quite soon after her death that she was in the court dressing the Queen and doing the mask costumes. Certainly, if you look at the portraits of the Queen, the early portraits of the Queen, she's covered in pink bows and trying to look very girly, although she has a wonderfully strong face. And her later portrait, she is in yellow ruffs and cuffs, and all the bows and all the fancy sort of rather girly stuff has gone, and she's looking far more authoritative and regal. And this is at the time when she was trying to claw back power, because the king was giving so much power to the favourite. So Robert Carr was the first favourite he gave political power to. So it was the first time the Queen had really had her nose put out of joint. So you can see why she would want to use Anne or a dresser anyway to give her greater authority, because clothing and how you presented yourself was so important then, much more important than today even. It was crucial how you appeared and what you wore. So for me, that all made sense.
Well, and then I'm just thinking too, everything you've said about how Anne and Francis were, how they were villainized. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, not just the murder, but also with the divorce and everything, as though everybody else was so pure and perfect, where it's like, it was, I think this also comes across in your book, that like the court was not full of like people living by the stated morals that they judged other people by. Like everybody, like there was people having lovers, like the stuff that they did was not out of sync with what all of the rest of everybody was doing. Mm.
Exactly. They were scapegoats. So they were used as scapegoats, Anne and Frankie, because they weren't doing, I mean, maybe the poisoning, if they even did that. And there's huge doubt over that. But they weren't doing anything unusual that other people weren't doing, except in some ways, Frankie was being more moral. So she could have just taken a lover as at least. So there's a famous historian called Lawrence Stone, who's estimated that about a third of the aristocracy were living apart from their husbands. Because of course, often these people having arranged marriages very young, they didn't tend to get on. So they separated from bed and board, but they didn't divorce. Mm-hmm. But they would have lovers, and it was a known bed swerving was a sort of a wonderful word. And this is what happened. So if Frankie's own mother-in-law was also the lover of Lord Cecil, and this is very well known. So the only difference really was that Frankie wanted to be to make her the man she loved, make him her husband. So, you know, bring him into a proper, so they would be in a proper marriage, which in a way you could argue is more moral than just keeping him as a lover and lying to the husband. But because she was, she did try and do this, and she was breaking the sort of rules of femininity, it brought down huge opprobrium on her head. So yes, the court, there's plenty, and there's also vast amounts of alcoholism and lots of sexual shenanigans between the same sex, different sex, all sorts of things. So it was considered quite an immoral place.
Mm-hmm. Well, and then just when you say the scapegoat, so when the murder plot, when the conspirators were all brought to trial, Francis was not executed. But spoiler, and yes. What?
Okay, that is a big spoiler. I suppose, yes, your readers, listeners know about the Overbury scandal, so they probably know that Anne was hanged. Yeah, well, that's why this book's called A Net for Small Fishes. So in the trial records, Richard Weston, who was Anne's, he was her husband's bailiff, and then he becomes her sort of protector, her male protector. He is hanged because he was complicit in the attempt to poison. And he said that the king's justice was a net for small fishes, so the big ones could swim away. So the big aristocrats, so in particular, Frankie's great uncle, Lord Northampton, who I feel was much more involved than came out because he died just before the trial. So he got away with it, really. But yeah, so the king's justice is a net for small fishes. So the lower class people, Western, and they suffered for it. But Frankie and Carr weren't hanged. But that doesn't mean they didn't suffer. So they did actually, I mean, they did suffer because Frankie said she was dead while living after Anne died. Uh-huh. So they didn't die, they weren't hanged, but they certainly, it certainly marred their life. Less so Robert Carr, he managed to sort of, he wasn't ever allowed back into court, but he was able to secure a very good marriage for his daughter, for their daughter. So he was still moving in aristocratic circles.
Well, it's sort of, you can sort of see the trickle-down effect of that. Like the person that came off like the best was the man, mm-hmm. and then next is like the noble woman, and then it's yep. the poor people, but especially the women. So the Anne. Women.
Yeah. So easy to victimize the women. I mean, there is at that time, there was this sort of stereotype of villainous women that hasn't changed that much today. And women were considered, they were the daughters of Eve. So they were born with sin. And their whole lives were meant to be about eradicating the sin with which they were born. So they had to behave absolutely perfectly throughout life. And there was this notion of sort of what we might call a sort of gateway sin. So even a very small sin, like liking to wear makeup or yellow ruffs or whatever, once you'd shown yourself capable of, say, vanity, you were therefore also capable of murder. Mm-hmm. So if you were capable of any sin,
yeah,
such as wearing mascara, then you would also be capable of murder, because mm-hmm. once you let the devil in, you could let any devil in, because women were of course much more irrational, much more prone to the devils being able to enter them because they were so emotional and so on and so forth. So there are all these sort of ideas around what women were and how they were much more likely to make pacts with the devil and be oversexed and all this dreadful stereotypical stuff. So it was rather perfect for, it was very easy in a way for the trial judge to make a case against them, because there were so many already sort of stereotyped ideas around women that these women could be very easily pushed into those stereotypes very easily.
So, well, I guess it's a funny thing to be talking to you about a book that's based, I mean, it's obviously a fiction book, but like you're telling real facts. So it's, you know, what is a spoiler or not, but the trial itself. So what was it was sort of like in your research, why do you think this, how did the story come out and who did it benefit to put these people on trial?
It came out because the king got tired of Robert Carr because he met Villiers, who was even more beautiful, more his cup of tea, wanted to get rid of Carr. Carr was very difficult about it, didn't want to be got rid of. And so it came out because the guy who was keeping, the keeper of the tower, he was called, wanted a job. He confessed to someone that he would be good for the job because he was very honourable, because when someone had taken some poison into the tower, he hadn't let the prisoner have the poison, and that showed that he was honourable. So of course the person who heard about this knew that would be a very good way to get favour from the king, because this would be, it was because he had confessed that it was Frankie and Anne who were trying to poison Overbury. And Frankie, by this point, was married to Carr. And so this man realized, gosh, this is political dynamite. And this is going to be a good way of getting rid of Carr. And then the king can have what he wants. And that will benefit me. So it's all very circuitous. But yeah. At the time, of course, the king was the font of all preferment. He was the one who had the money. He was the one who could give out the powerful positions. So you had to get into the king's favor. It was despotic in that way. So any way you could get into king's favor, people would do. So this was a good way. And the king, of course, did want to get rid of the car at this point, so he leapt on it too. And had it this come to light a couple of years earlier, it would have just been squashed, because at that mm-hmm. point Carr was in the ascendancy and no one would have wanted to move about against him. But the minute it looks like cars in a rockier position, then literally the wolves were just ready to descend, because he was unpopular with a lot of people, because he worked his way into the king's heart. He had too much power, he had too much influence, too much money. They were glad to see the back of him. Mm-hmm. And so then, again, she was the scapegoat. Frankie was the scapegoat.
For a plot that was ultimately, against Carr and pro Villiers. And
Well, their downfall, anyway, was certainly. So the plot to kill Overbury was in order for her to marry Carr, though whether she kills him or not, again, as I say, is very in doubt. But their downfall was because Carr was unable to play the game. So plenty of other royal favourites had just quietly gone into retirement, in fact, been delighted that they could get away from the king and just go and live their lives with all these wonderful estates and all this money that they've been given. And that's what had happened with previous royal favourites. They just slightly faded into the background. Mm-hmm. And they hadn't, they still had power, they were still at court and so on, but they just weren't the favourite. But Robert Carr refused to do that. He had these huge tantrums, again, documented in letters and so on, would wake the king up in the middle of the night to shout at him. And as I, make it clear in my book, he'd known the king since he was a baby, because his own father had died and the king had sort of brought him up in different ways. He'd always been put forward as his sort of paternal figure. So suddenly here's the king who has put you above all others, wanting someone else. It's a bit like wanting a second wife or something. I mean, it's quite difficult psychologically to deal with that. Mm. And Carr was not able to do that, and he became very, very angry with the king, and after a while the king just got fed up. So there was a period at court where the two favorites were vying for favor, and Villiers was actually very, very graceful towards Robert Carr, wanted his patronage, was prepared to be his sort of vassal, but Carr just wasn't having any of it and really just had massive tantrums, and in the end the king got tired of it.
And this is where I think, you've been able to do so much research to get, seeing letters and wills and things. But then where I find a book like yours is so important is to be able to make those connections, like your psychological understanding of the characters, like making the connections between, the queen was wearing this yellow ruff in this thing and Anne made the yellow ruff. So like clearly there's some connection there. So just making it into a narrative, but that really gives the understanding of why people did what they did, because so much of the historical record is either a list of names and dates, or it's these wildly, what Thomas Overbury wrote, like the very biased, like these demon women, these horrible women. Yeah, so you're kind of filling in the gaps there, I think.
I guess that's the beauty of writing a novel rather than a so-called historical event, because when I read the previous accounts, I wouldn't say they're any more fanciful than mine, frankly. They've just taken a very different perspective and have made all sorts of assumptions of their own. I think in some way mine is more honest. I mean, I'll make it clear it is a novel, but I have also made it clear I'm taking the perspective of the women and trying to understand their experience and trying to flesh out their motives to be much more what I would say authentic to life. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, I would say more in tune with the facts that are known, which are very few, really, being more honest about that, because we have no way of knowing whether they actually poisoned them or not. And even at the trial, they did say, we can't prove poisoning, and therefore we do away with proof, which is quite extraordinary. So I think, the joy of being able to write novels is that you can flesh it out as you feel fit.
And that was because you've written nonfiction before. Mm-hmm. So, but did you immediately know your approach to this was going to be fiction versus nonfiction?
Yes, I did. Because I guess because I really wanted to understand their world, and to do that, a lot of my research had to be more tangential. So looking into, so I could take you on a guided tour around Jacobean London if you wanted. I've looked so much at maps, the streets and how thin they were. And there's this wonderful book called Stowe's History of London. And he walks around London and he tells you. So Anne's house, the way I describe it, I get that straight from Stowe, who wrote this at the time that she was living in that house. So, and you can, in the, on the maps, you can see the street, Paternoster Row, you can see where it is in relation to this gate and that gate. And so you, there is an awful lot of fantastic historical research that is peripheral to this affair. So the affair itself, I haven't found, well, the accounts are very interesting in some respects, but not really about the women. But there are, there's other historical research, more recent historical research, which is absolutely brilliant. So hence, you can find out about the shopping centre that was built in 1609, and that if the apprentices peed in the top floor, then it would go down to the shops below. So they mustn't do that, and they mustn't kill dogs on the site. And you can find out such rich historical detail. The brothel that they go and see, there's a lots, there's, you know, wonderful accounts of this brothel. So I found I didn't have to make up very much. I really could find out so much about their world that then moving them around in this world became quite natural. And there were things women could and couldn't do. And there are accounts of, you know, the English women are so brazen because they go to pubs and they go to theatres. And so you can find out the sort of landscape of possibility for them. Mm-hmm. And so really most of the scenes that I have them in, there is some sort of documented evidence, and that's why I have them in those scenes. I haven't just magic things out of the air, that it comes from a lot of research. But yes, of course, dialogue and so on, and did they really feel this, and were they really in love with this person? Well, you make suppositions based on accounts and on what you feel would be humanly likely. Mm-hmm. But it's a novel.
Well, and I'm just thinking compared to letters and things, obviously, like that's direct first person information. Yeah. But other, like the accounts written at the time were effectively novels too, because those were people explaining the pamphlets and things. I mean,
yes,
you know, where exactly. People are like, here's what happened, where it's like, well, no, yeah. Like obviously, yeah. So even you have to be somewhat skeptical looking at things from that era.
Massively, yeah. Massively. And the accounts at the time, of course, are massively biased against women. So all of it you have to sift through like a sort of archaeologist meets a detective, because you're having to get rid of layers and layers of misogyny to then try and work out what might have happened. Mm-hmm.
So with your book coming out, so it's been out in the UK now for a while, and then it's just coming out in North America. So much historical fiction is like Henry VIII and his wives. You know, yeah. To the point that even like in Saskatchewan, it's like, that's just a thing people know. You're looking at something that to me and to the listeners, it's like, oh yeah, Frances Howard, this is great. But how much do people know about this in the UK? Like when you were just at this, is this a story people there know, or it's also pretty?
No, largely not, no. I mean, the Overbury affair, if you've studied that period of history, it is the biggest political, royal, sexual scandal, certainly of the Jacobean era, probably of the whole of the 17th century. Some historians have claimed of all time. You know, it was a massive, massive scandal, and it caused a lot of soul searching at the time, and has been looked into since. So it is huge, but yes, largely, interestingly, in this country, that period isn't much taught in schools. I think probably he's a difficult king for a slightly old-fashioned education system to get a handle on. Much easier to talk about Elizabeth and Henry than to talk about James. Easier to talk about the Civil War even than James. So he isn't much taught. So it's not a very well-known scandal. And the Howards, yes, the Henry VIII's wife, you know, that bit's known, Anne Boleyn. But really, the Tudors are such an object of fascination in this country that other than that, you know, you'd be hard-pressed to find someone who knew a lot about it. Mm-hmm. And I was very keen to write it, but that's why I didn't focus on Frankie or Frances Howard, because, as you say, Henry VIII's wives are talked about, various queens are sometimes written about, and duchesses, but more what you might call ordinary people, women, are not the subject of historical fiction. Mm-hmm. Very, very rarely. So I very much wanted her, Anne, to be the focus of the book. Because we don't talk enough about life outside the court. So in fact, although we've talked quite a lot, I have talked quite a lot about the court, a lot of the book is not set in the court. It's set in the city, it's set in back streets, it's set in London. It's not a court book. It's very much Anne's perspective.
Mm-hmm. No, and I'm interested to know, I was interested to know what people in the UK would know about this period, but that's the impression, yeah, I get just from what we see over here, you know, which documentaries or movies, it's always the same. It's like, yeah, Henry V, or it's the Tudors, or it's Queen Victoria.
And that's, yes,
that's kind of exactly it. So like,
yeah, a bit of civil war, yeah, that comes in a little bit, but yeah, no, you're so right. Jacobean, I mean, you get a bit of Shakespeare obviously goes into this period. I don't mention him in my book because I just feel that to mention Shakespeare in your book, you immediately summon up all sorts of images that I was deliberately trying not to summon up.
Yeah,
so yes, people will know a little bit. Perhaps there is some Jacobean drama they might know about, but yeah, generally it's not a particularly well-known period, which so, excited me. I was glad, yeah, to be able to bring this slightly, you know, to move on from the Tudors for a bit, I think is a good thing.
Well, that's what I was wondering too, like in terms of writing this, I was reading it as a person who's familiar with, well, not with Anne Turner, not with, as you were saying, outside of court what life was like, but in general the main players. So what was your thought process to sort of explain to people who might be coming to this from scratch, like people who don't know a thing about Jacobean England?
What was my thought process?
Yeah, just to explain it to people who are coming into this and might need to have their hand held a little bit.
I suppose what I wanted to do was write a sort of very grabbing, a book. I didn't want to give a history lesson. Mm-hmm. Because what really interested me was this friendship. The fact it happened to be true or was based on real historical events, and the fact it happened to be set nearly 400 years ago was sort of peripheral. I mean, obviously it was interesting and exciting for me that was the case, but it is definitely not a history lesson. And although I have done vast amounts of research, one of the things I'm most proud about with the reviews is that people say the research is very lightly worn. It's not heavy. I'm not at any point explaining, oh, so he was this and he was the chancellor, blah, blah, blah. Because that's not how you would write a contemporary novel. You wouldn't, yeah, sort of do that. You wouldn't bore people for half a page because you feel they ought to know something. So I suppose what I've done is if I feel something needs to be known, then it has to be worked into the story in a way that's fascinating. I'm not going to give history lessons at any point. And of course, with Google around, if you do want to know more about any characters, you can. I mean, you have to do it with caution. Wikipedia's entry on Anne and Frankie, I don't agree with all of it that's on there. But yeah, it's definitely not a history lesson. And I feel everything people need to know is in there, but it's much more what they need to know about them as characters and how they develop as characters rather than, you know, exactly what laws James passed when.
Yeah, no, and I, as a reader, I appreciate it. I tend to skim over those parts in books anyway, where it's just like, yeah, pages and pages of like, and so this person's grandfather was so and so. I'm like, where's the character?
It's terrible. That, yeah, is not good writing in my book. I mean, really, I mean, I don't think that's good writing. So I don't, I mean, I hope there's none of that in this book.
Mm-hmm. Well, no, I found, I mean, as a reader, like you jump right in, the characters are there. And I think as you explained it, yeah, you intentionally didn't put in these long paragraphs.
Yeah.
And exactly the same way as if it's a book, I don't know, Lord of the Rings or something. You're like, well, you know, this is the Shire and the people live there. You're like, okay, it's called the Shire. They're short. I got it. Like,
yeah, hairy feet. Yeah, exactly. You have to create a believable world. And I enjoy doing that so much. And I mean, I think that is a huge advantage of taking 8 years, because the first year or two, you get terribly overexcited about all these roughs and the carriages and the lovely little wooden houses and all this sort of stuff. And by year four or five, you're more of a resident. You've lived there now. Right. You've been back and forth for many years. So the things that you notice are the things that I would notice if I met you. I wouldn't be thinking, oh, she lives in a house made of brick and look, they've got asphalt on the floor and she drives a car, because you realize that's just, you know, you that is not what we notice. And if you're going to put in historical detail, it has to work very hard. It can't just be to set the scene. It has to say something about the character. So you can't just say, oh, she's wearing a ruff. The ruff has to mean something. It has to have an importance way beyond just description. So, I mean, I learned a lot writing this book because I did many drafts. And I would sit and read the drafts and I'd start yawning at the bits with long descriptions of the fashion or the history. You know, all that stuff is dull if it's given in a big dollop. Yeah. It has to work very hard. And you have to take out anything that sounds like you're preaching at your audience or teaching. You know, that is not the point of a good book.
Well, I would say, just from what you're saying and my experience reading it too, like the heart of it is, like you said, it's a contemporary book about a friendship between two women. And then it happens to be set in this place. And that's to the listeners listening to this who have not yet read it. That's what I would say, is that it's very much the story of, especially of Anne Turner, but her friendship with Frankie and just what life is like for women, which is my interest in history in general, just trying to fill in these gaps of what was the actual lived experience like, not what was written down saying, you know, everyone attended the mask and so-and-so was there. Like, I don't.
Yeah.
I just have one more question. So just, it was from the Wikipedia page because I was like, who is Anne Turner? So I was just sort of like trying to get what, basically I'm just like, is this all real? Like, who is this person? But it mentions that there's an Anne Turner character in a couple of dramas, like of Jacobean dramas. So I think where she's just sort of like an evil witch who shows up or something. Did you encounter any of that in your research?
Well, I have to confess, no. I mean, I came across her in lots of accounts and broadsheets and woodcuts and all this sort of thing. But these dramas they're talking about, they are not Jacobean, I think. I think they're later.
Must have been newer,
I think so. So no, those are not things. I thought what you were going to mention was the fact she was hanged in her yellow ruffs and cuffs.
Oh, well, I wasn't sure if that was a spoiler, but I love that detail. Is that true?
No.
Oh.
Absolutely. No, it is not true. From what is... At the time, there were many accounts written at the time, and no one mentions that. No one. And it would have been such a good detail that had she been hanged in those. And I think she deliberately wasn't, because she very much portrayed herself as a repentant woman who had turned to Protestantism. So she would not have gone with her ruffs and cuffs. So I think that was very inaccurate in the Wikipedia page, with a few other things I think are a bit inaccurate. So in the book, there's an that, well, I don't want to, you will see what happens to the ruffs and cuffs in the book, because there is a scene around that. But no, she almost certainly didn't get hanged in them.
Okay.
So yes, I thought that's what you were going to mention then, not these other plays.
I'm just looking at it now again. Maybe I just skimmed it poorly, but yeah, it's what it is there were novels. There's like a 1930 novel, there's a 1964 novel, but they're mostly the murder.
Those I have read. And they are, again, they're very interested in the murder, and they are unquestioning about the villainy of these two women. And again, they don't go into their motivation at all. I mean, to such an extent, I just find it extraordinary that it's just assumed, well, they are just evil women. Of course they would do that. Really, the only person who really questions it is an English academic called Professor Linley, David Linley. So he's looking at the literature of the time in a fascinating book about the trials. In fact, anyone who is interested in this period and wants to know more about it, I think the book, The Trials of Francis Howard by David Linley, is a much better source, because he looks at all the literature at the time, all the stereotypes around women and so on, and how easy it is to push Frankie and Anne into those stereotypes, and how unfair, based on what is the actual facts. There's no sort of justice in that. So, but most other people just accept it unquestioningly.
Well, you know, that just makes me think, I mentioned at the beginning, there was the quote on your website where somebody described the book as the Thelma and Louise. And I'm just thinking, like, my first thought was Thelma and Louise, like, oh yeah, two women doing crimes. But it's like, no, that's a movie about two women who are like victimized and pushed into this situation where it's like, oh, actually, the way you're talking about it as well, it's not a crime spree. It's two women who just like were put into this kind of terrible position and kind of did what they could. And that's exactly what the characters in your book are doing.
And they are defying toxic masculinity in a big way. I mean, that wonderful scene where there's that horrible tanker driver who was so sexually aggressive towards them on the road, and then they blow up his tanker. I mean, in a way, that's what these women were doing. They were blowing up the tanker in the middle of James's court. And I think that's just the most wonderful. I was very happy when Lawrence Norfolk said that about them, because it is very much in that spirit. Here are these women defying the impositions on them of a patriarchy.
Whenever I read a story like this, I mean, your novel, but also just the experience of the women, I think, oh, wow, look at these women, like, bucking convention, like, you know, breaking this glass ceiling or whatever. And then it's like, oh, but nothing changed, you know? It's like you read about people where it must have felt like, oh, this is, even like you were saying with the yellow coat, men are wearing it, women are wearing it, all different classes. It's like in another reality that could have led to some societal change, but it didn't. You know, there's so many moments where I feel like, look at these women doing this great thing and whatever, the year 900. And then it's like, well.
Yeah, here we are still doing it.
Didn't really pay off, did it? So I love seeing these moments of feminism, I guess, for lack of a better word, where they wouldn't have known where it would lead, but it could have led to a greater societal change. It just didn't happen to. So it's not just women weren't sitting around being good wives throughout all of history.
Quite beautifully put. I love the way you put that. I think this the Overbury affair and the scandal around the divorce actually did lead to some change. It did lead to a discussion about arranged marriages. There was already some discussion going on, but Frances Howard's divorce from Essex was such a cause célèbre that it did lead to a lot of soul searching around arranged marriages and whether it was a good idea or not. So I think that did actually lead to some change and to the understanding that really you shouldn't really use your children as pawns in a marriage game. You should at least have give them some chance to decide if they like that person or not. So this was a period when that did change. Those events were partially responsible for that. So that's, I like the fact that I feel that they did actually have some impact on history.
Mm-hmm. So just to sort of, so the book, A Net for Small Fishes, at the time that people are listening to this, it's out, it's available in North America now as well as in the UK. I guess ultimately, this is, I don't know if this is a good wrap-up question, it might be a huge question. What do you want people to take away from this book? What was your intent? Like, what are you hoping people get out of this?
Well, I want them to enjoy themselves. I like a book that I actually enjoy reading and I feel nourished at the end of it because I feel I've really learned something I didn't know, but I've been made to think and feel and so on. But I suppose what I really feel is that we need to know our history, because our history is very important to how we make our present. So how we see women in history is terribly important to how what we fight for, what we want to protect, what we care about, and how we see ourselves. So I think the more accounts we can have, the more we can understand our history, not just from a white male perspective, the better that is.
Mm-hmm. Well said. Thank you so much for joining us on this podcast. I was so excited to talk to you. Firstly, I was just like, I was excited to read the book, and then I was like, I'm just excited to talk to someone else who knows about Frances Howard.
Well, she's fantastic. If you could have someone at a dinner party. Oh, I definitely want her and Anne. I'd love to actually meet them.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's, well, like you were saying, you have to call her Frankie. Like, you've spent so much time with her.
Yeah.
Like, you feel like you know her. And I think through the book, like, you really get a sense of who she is as a character, which is great beyond, here's her portrait and here's kind of a couple paragraphs about who she was. It's like, well, no, like, as a person. So I really appreciated the characterization of the book. Like, it's very much a character-driven book.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you. I've really enjoyed being on your podcast.
Thank you so much.
It's so nice to meet a fellow person who's interested in Frances Howard.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
So that was my interview with Lucy Jago, author of A Net for Small Fishes, now available all over the place. I recommend this book super highly. You can pick it up, I mean, wherever you get your books from your local independent bookstore, your favorite online book ordering service, which maybe is that same local independent bookstore. If you're more of a library user, borrow it from your library. If your library doesn't have it, like basically every library has a form or something you can fill in to suggest a book. So you can like suggest your library buy it. Did you know libraries also have audiobooks and ebooks? You could suggest they get it for those services as well. Just whatever you need to do. I mean, I can't imagine anyone has got to this point in this podcast and doesn't want to read this book. So read the book and enjoy. So yeah, so inspired by this discussion with Lucy and everything we all just learned today about yellow ruffs and what that has to do with living a tits out lifestyle, I've added, there's a bunch of new stuff in the Vulgar History merch store. So if you go to vulgarhistory.store, vulgarhistory.store, you'll find we've got our holiday stuff there. We've got tits the season. We've got tits out for the holiday. There's a Hanukkah themed product or product, a shirt and I think a mug that says Candelicious, like Scandalicious, but Hanukkah style. And then in honor of Francis Howard, I've added or re-added back in some tits out Francis Howard merchandise that's all yellow just because that's her color now. I mean, I will post on Instagram, and by the time you listen to this, hopefully you'll see it there, the picture that we all know and love of Frances Howard. Like I've looked at it a million times and I never noticed her ruff is yellow ruffs. Like, so like tits out, ruffs are yellow. Like this is, I don't know, I'm gonna have to work that into our catchphrase apparently. Oh, and also when you're on the store, remember you can use code tits out for free shipping in the US, or tits out 10, TITSOUT 10 for 10% off. And you can also support this podcast. I have a Patreon, which is patreon.com/AnnFosterWriter. And that's where you get early access to episodes of Vulgar History. There's polls and things. You can help me choose what to talk about on the podcast. And notably for this, so I also have bonus episodes on there called So This Asshole, where I talk about various men who annoy me from history. And two of the people mentioned in today's episode, I've done So This Asshole episodes about James the First, the king, and also George Villiers, the man who replaced Robert Carr as the king's favorite. So, you know, you can get like a whole experience of who all these people are, etc. So patreon.com/AnnFosterWriter. Most of my communication about the show is done on Instagram lately, so you can find us there at Vulgar History Pod. Make sure to check the stories. That's where I leave updates and stuff often. And then also I do my best to keep up on Twitter too, and that's Twitter at Vulgar History. So I hope you really enjoyed the show. I really hope that you enjoy this book. I think this book would be a great gift to give. If you're giving gifts this holiday season, what better than a book about the Thelma and Louise of the Jacobean era? So keep your mask on, keep your tits out, and I'll talk to you again soon.
Anna Sheridan, New York Times bestselling author of supernatural horror. Missing for nearly 6 months now.
That's not possible. Is the compass broken? Or did I turn to the side?
Given the circumstances of her disappearance, someone with a more vivid imagination might decide she'd pierced the veil, so to speak.
Weak radio signal. 700 meters. Closing fast.
There's no place for ghost stories and close encounters in this investigation, or any other.
I need you to find me.
To save yourself.
Of course. What else would it be?
The Sheridan Tapes, a serialized horror mystery podcast. Stream the complete series today on Realm and on all podcasting platforms.